Welcome to Industry Insights, a podcast from the European Film Market in cooperation with Goethe-Institut. My name is Johanna Koljonen. I'm a media analyst and experienced designer based in Sweden, and I'll be your host for this premiere episode of the podcast. Industry Insights is a show for, by, and about the film industry. And in this first episode, we'll be leaning heavily into the insights part. It is my great pleasure to welcome Research Director Guy Bisson from Ampere Analysis joining us from the UK. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk today about changes to the TV landscape on a sort of high level, changes that are already occurring, tendencies that you can see in your data today. And I thought that that's probably where we should start with the method. So for listeners who are not familiar, what is Ampere Analysis and what do y'all do?
Well, Ampere is a London-based firm of specialist entertainment analysts. We track the exploitation of content from the cinema onwards, and we really work with research, strategy, and marketing teams at large media companies, particularly studios, broadcasters, telecoms and pay TV operators, channel groups, and technology companies. Very global in outlook. Everything we do is about the entire world. We're not just focused on Europe. And one of the things that we do differently is pull in insight from consumer research, very deep and detailed content analytics, and then more traditional forecasting, financial forecasting, and performance forecasting for the operators, channels, and players within the business. So it gives a very holistic view of the industry as a whole.
It does. It's so wonderful to hear you speak because you always seem to know what everybody else is watching. And I guess I have to ask an informal question here. When you watch TV, do you feel you're working?
Absolutely not. One thing I'm very, very good at is switching off. And once I've switched to Netflix or Sky or one of the providers, that's it. I'm definitely not working.
No, that's great. I'd like to start out with the two macro trends that no one can have missed. The continuing pandemic, obviously, and the accelerating transition of the major studios towards the direct-to-consumer strategy. Could you start by setting those two big themes up for us?
Absolutely. And I think they're particularly fascinating. And what's so fascinating about them is they could not be more different. They could not have come from more different positions. And yet the impact on so many aspects of the industry and on consumers with regard to the way that they're engaging with television and with content is very similar. So out of the blue, we've had this pandemic hit in the first quarter of last year. What did it do? It led to lockdowns all around the world. People were locked up at home. They turned to streaming services. At the same time, it shut down global TV production, particularly high-end scripted production. And it led to studios with cinemas closed beginning to accelerate their experimentation with content windowing, so pushing theatrical releases straight to streaming. The impact of that was that it pushed better content onto those streaming platforms, which created a cycle whereby that acceleration in audience shift got even faster and faster. At the same time, put COVID aside and pretend it never happened, the studios already were going direct and changing that strategy. So a similar impact. They started pushing more and more of their content onto those streaming platforms, and they started commissioning high-end originals for those streaming platforms, which had the same effect. It accelerated that audience shift and that engagement. So completely different cycles, completely different causes, same effect. And the end result is that while we, of course, expected an acceleration of streaming change in 2020 before we'd even heard of COVID, it got that much faster and that much more embedded. And I think that's the really interesting interaction between those two core things that happened in 2020.
It's fascinating. Even the streamers themselves had no idea. They've had to adjust their targets many times during the last years. And now their projections, of course, for the next 3 to 5 year period looks even more intense. But I think maybe we should break it up a little bit, slightly by content type. So if we start with the window system for feature films, and of course there's a lot of talk obviously about this in the industry, the window system for releasing feature films is clearly changing. So how would you say that affects the ecosystem as a whole?
That's a really important question. I think it's another thing that studios had wanted to do, at least to some degree, and were partially held back by the exhibition industry until COVID came along and forced everybody's hands. I think what's interesting about that is the economic balance and where that tipping point lies in respect of, does it make sense, assuming we come through this in 6 or 12 months, does it make sense to continue to push movies into the streaming platform and bypass the theatrical window? And as you've just alluded to, I think the position is shifting constantly. You know, what we probably thought 6 months ago has moved on a bit from what we now think. I think the answer to that is that we will go back to the theatrical window. I think it will still be strongly supported by the studios. It's important for marketing content. It's important on the knock-on effect it has on value on subsequent exploitation. I think that's particularly true for higher budget releases. But it's a little more questionable for slightly lower budget releases, where the economic balance between the money you can make from pushing it to a PVOD window or a streaming platform versus theatrical, they're a little bit closer in terms of the income for the studios. That said, I think we have passed a point where, and this is what I was referring to earlier, 6 months ago I would have said definitely not big budget releases when we're through this. We'll continue to go to PVOD. But now I would say probably occasionally they will, particularly on platforms like Disney, possibly Warner, because of the promotional effect they will have on that streaming platform and the subscriber acquisition impact they will have on those increasingly important platforms.
So PVOD, in case somebody hasn't heard this term yet, I'll just spell it out. Of course, that's premium video on demand. And by that, we mean a transactional streaming window that is happening, that is adjacent to or replacing the simultaneous with the theatrical premiere. Can be slightly before, can be slightly after, can be at the same time. And then the idea is that if you choose to watch it at home, you pay quite a lot more than you would even for a ticket in the cinema. They've been priced very differently, but we can talk about perhaps 20, 30, 40 even euros, depending on the title. And sometimes that's done on a subscription platform as well. So you have to be a subscriber first. The very different models here, we'll see what sticks. But I mean, I think it's fascinating what you're saying here. I think perhaps we've just thought of it a little bit too simply. We have to have many thoughts in our minds at the same time. I think, just as you do, that audiences will absolutely rush to have that shared physical experience, at least those who haven't been hit too hard personally by the pandemic will perhaps, you know, I think we'll get through the fear pretty soon and really we'll see a boost probably in those kinds of live type events like theatrical exhibition. At the same time, in the last decade, we've made a lot of movies that didn't perform in theatrical, especially mid-sized movies, but quite a lot of films that were just losing money in that window. And as you say, for them, PVOD might be a much better deal. Or some kind of transactional release plan.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Now, there's also this other window system or release pattern that is quietly disappearing. And that was the historical cycle of American TV content, which would start out on some kind of premium service or network and generate value through pay TV or advertising, and of course also being sold across territories, which is how we saw that content in Europe, and then sometimes in the US ending up in syndication, which from the consumer perspective is those shows that are always on. You know, you turn on the TV and those shows are always on. Those would have been in syndication. So then those rights would be working for the rights holders for decades often. And And moving away, moving towards direct-to-consumer, of course, is also about switching this system, which in Europe doesn't affect us as directly. But could you talk a little bit about what that does on a sort of systems level to TV?
Yeah, there are two fundamental transitions, I think, within that question. One is a simple one, that the channel business is shifting to a streaming channel business. That on its own fundamentally doesn't change the value chain of exploitation. As you rightly say, what changes the value chain is the fact that the companies that were do produce a lot of the content are now going direct. That is the fundamental change for the first time in effectively a 100-year history of the studios. They are bypassing their traditional partners. And that has all sorts of impacts down the value chain. It has an impact, of course, on the supply of content to third parties. It's not just other streamers like Netflix, but it's TV channels as well. It has an impact on the distribution business, and particularly international distribution business, businesses that might have taken some of that content on board to sell into those international markets. And it has an impact on the whole subscriber relationship with content and with the brands that supply that content. Traditionally, we didn't think as consumers of, particularly with some exceptions, Disney possibly being one of them, but with most exceptions, we didn't think of the studio when we watched a piece of content on a TV channel. Increasingly, that is the brand that will be presenting that content to us. So the whole dynamic of the value chain has changed, not actually because of streaming, because that's just a shift of one means of distributing television to another means, and we've had lots of technical shifts like that in the past. But it's that disruption to the content, business-to-business value chain, that is absolutely fundamental. And of course, it changes the whole competitive dynamics of the business as well, as soon as those studios go direct.
Do you think it will create opportunities for European content internationally in the US market, perhaps, but also in the rest of the world, as some of this US content might not be as available?
Yeah, so it absolutely does. I mean, not that on its own, that is one aspect of it, but just the fact that the business has moved towards truly global platforms, so Netflix, Amazon, Disney+, they really are the first truly global consumer-facing channels, if you like. And that fundamentally changes the opportunities, because they need local interest content. And increasingly, because of the rights situation around accessing rights on a global basis, it makes more sense to produce that content. So that has driven the massive upswing in non-US production that we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years. That is an opportunity, absolutely, for European and other rest of world producers. So I think the market is more dynamic than it has ever been for non-US content. No. More accepting of non-US content, and more accepting of non-English, particularly, content than it's ever been before.
Now, you said that the last 3 to 4 years of that this has already been happening, and of course that's correct. And the number of these big the studios are, the US majors are only now sort of launching, globally speaking, their direct to consumer offerings internationally, and of course also we're seeing regional or local streamers also getting in the game in a big way. So it seems that the streaming market is going to continue to grow, also driven, of course, by the realities of the pandemic, or accelerated by that. So yes, the world economy is struggling, but streaming, ironically, is doing incredibly well. So we were in a boom, and this boom hasn't been halted, really, by the pandemic. So I guess my question to you is, how long can it continue? Will it contract at some point?
So you're right. We did some analysis of each of the windows and the impact of COVID, and the only one that grew was streaming. So everything else was down. Theatrical was very hard hit. free-to-air TV in terms of advertising very hard hit. Slight boost to home entertainment, so digital rental, but the streaming market grew massively. Netflix, in the beginning of the year, talked about a concept that they called carry forward. They said, look, we're going to see a lot of growth in the first half because of lockdown, but then we expect it to slow down in the second half. And lo and behold, it didn't slow down at all. And you'll have seen the growth of Disney as well, how rapidly that is continuing to grow. Of course, it's going to slow at some point, but I absolutely can't see it contracting, not least because we are talking about a fundamental transition. So even if there was no growth per se in the uptake of streaming, you've still got this massive traditional business that still needs to transition fully to streaming. So think of the entire TV channel business that is gradually shifting over. So just that provides a great deal of growth opportunity in terms of the overall business. And I can't see it slowing down at all. And in terms of the content production boom, again, that will ease off, but it's not going to go into reverse. I don't think we're, I think as I've stated quite often, I don't think we're in a bubble. We are definitely in a boom and we're in a fundamental transition. And that's going to continue to see a lot of change over the near term.
So one thing that might change, I mean, I'm hoping that it's exactly as you say, then that we sort of settle at this relatively high level. That would be fantastic. But right now, as all of these services are competing to establish themselves in markets, they are putting, or the exclusivity of the content is incredibly important to them. And when I speak to producers and sales agents, and actually also to streamers, they sort of say, well, the exclusive content, those originals, that's what's going to make the subscriber try your service and commit to your service. But once they're there, if you just want to keep them from sort of churning out, you want to keep them subscribing, there just needs to be stuff for them to watch. And that other stuff, the rest of the catalog, doesn't necessarily have to be exclusive. And this suggests to me that in a few years, once all of these services are sort of finding their place in the market, we might see a little bit more of a distribution market that in some ways reminds us more of how it's worked before. Can we say anything at this point of how that's going to work? And do you agree with their analysis that exclusive content is going to be less central perhaps 3 or 4 years from now?
So I agree partially, but I think what it applies to is acquired content. Original content created by Netflix and other streamers will remain, I believe, exclusive to those platforms rather than then being sold into onto other players and other platforms. What we see in the data already is actually for both acquired and original that the content tends to be exclusive on a single platform at a given point in time. And then it's the acquired content that will pop up on another platform a year down the line. So they are continuing to license once the rights deal expires for the acquired content. But I think for the original, that continues to be a very important driver for the platforms, and it will continue to be so. So I think there's a two-pronged approach to how content licensing will continue.
And that would seem, again, to offer some opportunities for instance, the national broadcasters and other sources of sort of qualitative, for instance, TV drama content that can actually be monetized internationally, even if you need to keep that first window or your national market for yourself. You can do it in collaboration with international services, of course, but you can also... We can really think of a more sort of traditional distribution reappearing for those kinds of projects.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's even reappearing. I'm not sure it even went away. It's just that, you know, as we talk about the latest trends and the things that are really changing and driving the industry, there's a natural human tendency to think it's all or nothing, but of course it isn't. The things that you and I are talking about now clearly are happening, but they're not everything that's happening. And the traditional models are still operating and still very important to the industry. One slight point I would make on that, though, is that one of the things that streaming does is open up the opportunity for broadcasters to have a global platform. And we're seeing that increasingly, particularly in Europe, not so much in the Americas and Asia. But there are many examples, Viaplay being one in Scandinavia, but been very vocal about their plans to launch in 2029 markets. BritBox in the UK, similar global rollout plans. So the as that strategy begins to grow, then we almost have another factor pushing those broadcasters to retain the rights for themselves and for their own platforms and to keep them exclusive. Again, it will apply to their own production and the high budget production and not so much to what they're acquiring in the open market. But I think it's a second interesting dynamic that the broadcasters who have always been regional or single market players often are now seizing the opportunity to take their brands and their platforms through streaming to a much wider geographic footprint. So again, that could change things in the coming few years.
To me, that's incredibly exciting because it also allows us to talk in a way and think about something else, talk about another kind of landscape than the sort of, you know, Netflix's and Amazon's, which are, I mean, of course, or some companies like Apple and Amazon, which are among the biggest in the world, no matter how you count. In a way, it feels like, obviously, if you want to compete with them just on budgets, that's just not going to be possible. And I think it feels like an enormous relief to be able to sort of set that aside and say, oh, yes, but there's this enormous streaming market and these enormous global opportunities, which are very different from what we've seen, especially if you come from a smaller country like a Nordic one, or even a market like Germany that historically hasn't had enormous international successes for its content. The playing field has changed.
The playing field has changed significantly, and we haven't even mentioned advertising-supported platforms, particularly the international ones, who are providing a market, a large market for what you could call deep archive or library content. At the moment, they are heavily reliant on much, much older content that might not otherwise have found a sales opportunity. So again, it's coming back to that point about not focusing entirely on what Netflix is doing and Disney is doing and that trend. There are all sorts of other trends going on underneath, and one of them is the opportunities that even Amazon provides for monetizing archive and library content outside of the Amazon Prime platform with the Amazon Direct opportunity, but also new entrants like Tubi and Vudu and some of those big US-driven but international AVOD platforms are providing a new market for that older content.
Here are national broadcasters that are advertising, those that are advertising financed might need to move pretty fast to be serious about the streaming game, to keep their existing audiences and their existing national reach, I think, because it's clear that those international competitors are coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think national broadcasters are in a, if we were to segment the market, because of the quality and recency of their content, particularly the drama production that they go into, but also because they are a deposit is the wrong word, but they're the place that people go for example, reality content and light entertainment and chat shows and all the other things that, you know, we don't talk about so often because maybe they're not as exciting as drama and high-end drama, but they're really important for driving the audience. And that's where regional broadcasters are strong, and they're strong in locally significant, high-value drama production as well, which sets them apart, certainly at the moment, from those international AVOD players who are reliant on very large catalogues of quite old and lower quality content. So the market's definitely segmenting. But I think that places, ironically, it places the local broadcasters often in competition more directly with Netflix and Disney, because of that's where the quality drama is appearing at the moment on those platforms and on the national broadcaster platforms.
Now, you mentioned Disney again. That made me think of this. Earlier, you sort of nodded to Disney as a kind of special case. They own so many story brands that have a genuinely global audience. And of course, some of that library they've been building on for 80 years. But I mean, Pixar and Star Wars and Marvel are all relatively recent acquisitions. I want to say perhaps in the last decade, they could see where this was heading. And they made some expensive investments that have really paid off for them. And I wonder, could you speak a little bit to what Disney did with those massive brand generating machines and why it works?
Well, again, talking of ironic, who would have thought that a cartoon mouse invented in 1928 would provide the perfect strategy for the way that the entertainment business works today? But it's absolutely true. I mean, Walt Disney was religious in his need and desire to keep control of the character that was Mickey Mouse. So you can call it the Mickey Mouse strategy, because that's exactly what it is. That control of IP is so important today, because it comes back to pretty much everything we've just talked about. The need for global rights. Okay, if you need global rights, own production makes a lot of sense. Where do you source material for own production? If you can source it internally from your own characters and franchises, so much the better. If you own it already, so much the better. So all of these strategies rise to the fore and become incredibly important because we've moved to this world of global platforms, global rights. And the control of IP, I think, is one of the next frontiers of battle among media groups. In a way, they've always had at least one eye on the control and the ownership of content and characters, but I think it's become, very recently, in the last 18 months, one of the primary strategies of investment for all of the major studios and content owners is to look for sources of character rights and for something that can be taken and monetized in that way. And that's why we've seen lots of deals recently to acquire comic franchises, podcast platforms, even music catalogs that potentially give greater control of characters and character rights, and that's going to be accelerating over the coming years.
Yeah, characters and story worlds as well.
Absolutely.
So sometimes it can even be an original piece of content in some other medium that perhaps, you know, that wasn't a global success or anything, but it has a world that is good for telling stories in. What concerns me about this is that there are very few truly global story brands available that aren't already owned by a massive company. So that's one problem. And another is, where do we make new ones that in an industry focused on adaptations and monetizing existing IP in new ways and in new platforms? Because it felt safer, that has taken resources away from developing original IP, and eventually we will need new things, and we will need new things to stay relevant to the contemporary moment too.
Yeah, and it's very clear from the drama adaptations that we're tracking that they are exploring those new platforms for the creation of ideas and content. So we've seen an upswing in content adaptations from blogs, from podcasts, from computer games, from comic and manga books. So all of these sources of content are ascending in importance in terms of looking for that next global character and that next global story. The book, the novel, is still the most important. But increasingly, content creators are turning to these other sources. And again, that's another trend that we would expect to continue to accelerate as we move through the coming years.
Then that's also sort of from the producer's perspective, I suppose, if you're a writer, if you're a screenwriter in particular, and you want to do something, you have a script for an original story, perhaps you may in fact want to test it on another platform first, and that might be a way to do a proof of concept that will actually help you get the film made eventually.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I think that's about what we have time for. Guy, of course, you have a talk scheduled during the FM where you're going to touch upon some of these topics and also a bit more about specifically what kinds of content audiences are looking for. That's going to be on Wednesday at 4:30 at the Berlinale Series Market. Do you have any tips or alluring hints about what you'll say that we could add to this?
No, I would advise everyone to watch it, though. There's going to be some interesting data on what's getting commissioned, for example, and also a look at the trends in terms of streamers versus those traditional broadcasters that we were just talking about, and how not only COVID has impacted them differently, but how they're approaching the future of content slightly differently as well. So some very interesting points going to come out of that, I hope.
We started with a personal question. I'm going to have to land on a personal question as well. For you personally, what is the most exciting thing about this field right now?
For me, I think it always has been content. It sounds like a cop-out to say that, because of course we're focusing in this talk and in our analysis on content. But I think what's most exciting is the way that that has evolved, so that the movie and the cinema, while still incredibly important, is not the be-all and end-all of high-end, high-budget, high-engagement content. And it's that massive expansion of choice, of voice and story, that has come from the boom in high-budget scripted TV content and added to our enjoyment in the home, that is the most exciting for me, absolutely. And you know, as we've been talking about, it's so fundamental now to the way that different players and different platforms differentiate themselves from one another and continue to compete in an increasingly complex global market. So content is just endlessly exciting to me.
And for once, the sort of strategic changes are genuinely sort of feeding creative exploration as well, which is super fun.
Yes.
All right, Guy, thank you so much for taking the time. That was so interesting as usual. What's your website?
Ampereanalysis.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes as well for people to find you there. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
So that was all for today. I'll just like to tell you a few words about what's going to be happening in your feed in the next week. As the EFM rolls around, my colleague Julia Fidel will get you a daily EFM morning brief to help you navigate the market. And in the next full-length episode of Industry Insights, you'll hear from me again with my media analyst hat on. I'll be presenting some highlights from the Göteborg Film Festival's 8th annual Nostradamus report, looking at the change in the screen industry. And I will talk to a really exciting producer, John Giwa-Amo, who is already working in the future. You don't want to miss that, so hit subscribe on your podcast provider or look us up at www.efm-berlinale.de. Industry Insights is a podcast from the European Film Market in cooperation with Goethe-Institut. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.